Well, thank you, Lynn and Jenny, for asking me to do this, and it's been an intellectual adventure that I will remember its weight for me probably the rest of my life. And I am very appreciative of having to learn something that I maybe did not want to learn. And we're going to start, Bob, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to introduce who we are, because I think it's called Among Friends here. Nancy, Lisa, and I, went to Middlebury College in Vermont in the early mid-70s, and Nancy was there because she was married at that time to Chaim Steinbach, and you would know Chaim as a...
And he's here.
Hi, Chaim. And you would know Chaim now as a sculptor. At that time, he was a painter, and he was he had just graduated from Yale Graduate School, and he was my design teacher and my painting teacher. And if you know Chaim's work, you can imagine what a brilliant design teacher Chaim was for me. And Lisa also was a student of Chaim's. It was a very small art department at the school, but I think we got a very good education, all told, art-wise. And for just as an aside, for every studio course we took, you had to take an art history course. Now, in my youthful wisdom, I thought this was the stupidest thing I ever heard, but it's actually one of the smartest things, and I think it should be mandatory in every school. Now, okay, so then we all moved to New York. Nancy, I think, first, and then Lisa, a year ahead of me, and her and some other mutual friends pioneered a loft on Mercer Street, and I moved in with them, and then we were all living in a very small neighborhood at that time. And I think that was the beginning of our bonding. And Nancy, she taught an adjunct course of photography at Middlebury, so I was aware of her artwork then, which was a black and white photographer. And as I said earlier, I think Nancy was very reluctant to accept me as a friend, but ultimately I won her over.
We had breakfasts,
yes,
every morning at some diner.
The guy I was living with, Steve Wolf, who he thought we were crazy. We would call each other at 6 in the morning and say, "Hi, do you want to have breakfast?" And we'd go have, you know, we'd go out to a diner and have breakfast.
Yeah.
Brett, you have to self-identify.
Which I refuse to do on some level. I'm the new kid on the block, although it feels like, on the news they always say, it feels like a lifetime would happen just yesterday in the news. Well, I kind of feel like that, and my news mostly comes from Nancy in a lot of ways. I've gotten roped into her life of her eye, which is a voracious thing, its appetite. And we've been collaborating the last bit, and we'll be continuing to collaborate over the next period of time. So I'm very excited about how things have been so interconnected and interwoven. It feels like our collaboration is also some form of weaving at this point, that everything has become a metaphor for everything else. It feels very cosmic at this point. So I'm happy to be here, but I'm just getting to know the two of you.
And we thought Lisa, being the professional among us, a weaver.
Oh.
Am I right?
Oh, no, you are, because I didn't introduce her properly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Lisa was a political philosophy
major
in college, and came to New York like all of us, and work political philosophy major, working at Bruno's Bakery, trying to figure out like what. You know what to do, and she told us much better than me, but she developed an interest in weaving, and she went to work for Jacqueline Earl Larson, who some of you might know, and that's when I became interested in weaving, was really through your interest in weaving. And then she went back to school to RISD, and she's taught at RISD and taught weaving, and she also does independent prototypes for manufactured fabrics on her own. Is that an accurate way to say it?
Yep.
Okay. So Lisa's going to go.
Lisa's going to give us a short idea of what the structure of weaving is?
Well, it's not so much that as that was some of the issues that Annie Albers were grappling with, was grappling with in these pieces. So I'm a teacher, so it's formal to sit back. For Annie Albers, weaving was a process of structural organization, and how these pieces shown here articulate that organization and the manipulations of systems of woven structure, color, and material is something that I'd like to show. In most forms of hand weaving, a harness is the mechanism through which the warp yarns are threaded through individual heddles. These are the harnesses, this is the individual heddles on each harness. And it is through the lifting of the harnesses that some sets of warp threads can be raised, like here too, while others stay down, thus creating...
I think we need your cursor.
Yeah, it's near, your cursor is not working.
Is it working now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Showing the harness.
This is the harness. This is also the harness.
Because I didn't know.
Through which the individual threads are being threaded through these heddles per harness. And it's through the lifting of the harnesses that some sets of warp threads get raised while the others stay down, thus creating an interlacing of horizontal and vertical threads when a weft passes through across the width of the fabric. Each harness on the loom allows for a different set of threads to act independently of the others, enabling the weaver to create a wide range of weave structures that create a single layered plane of cloth. It is the number of harnesses, and here you see a loom with 4 harnesses, here one with 16 harnesses, but it's the number of harnesses on a loom that really sets the limitations on the configurations of weaves within a piece. And in this work of Annie Albers, it sets a limitation on the configuration of double weave blocks. Double weave blocks in which there are 2 separate warps and wefts weaving 2 layers of cloth that can exchange positions from face to back. Through creating weave structures that bring different combinations of the 2 color warps and the 2 color wefts as color blocks onto the face of the cloth, Albers was able to configure the compositions of her work. By using 3 vertical configurations of blocks, which here you can see, which she repeats, but somewhat irregularly, this is 1 block, and then she repeats it here again and again and again. Here's a 2nd block, repeated again and again and again, and the third block. It's through the repetition of blocks that she's able to stay within a limit of harnesses. And so it's critical to her planning out of her compositions some of these restrictions of harness weaving. But she figured this out so it could be woven on a 24 harness loom. And they exist. I have one that I do prototypes. I weave prototypes for them in my studio for industrial production. And this piece would require more harnesses because now there are 3 warps, a white and a red and a black warp. In fact, it would require 36 harnesses. And this too is ordered in sort of an irregular order or repetition of the 3 individual vertical configurations of blocks. So she worked out these compositions based on the systems and constraints of harness weaving. One requiring 24 harnesses, the other requiring 36 on the right. But the crazy thing is that there were no looms at the weaving workshop, the Bauhaus weaving workshop, with this many harnesses. There were 8 harness looms, which would not nearly have been enough harnesses for her to do this work. And there were jacquard looms. And in a jacquard loom, there are no harnesses. In fact, every single end can act individually, independently of each other. thus creating incredible flexibility in the configuration of compositions, designs, or patterns. And one would have thought that this would have liberated Annie Albers from the necessity of using the block and grid-based work of harness weaving. She could have done something like this, which is a fabric that one of my students developed at RISD on the Jacquard loom there. Or she could have done something like this, which was designed by William Morris. Both designs exploiting the flexibility of the Jacquard loom in creating visual pattern configuration compositions. But Annie Albers, in spite of using the Jacquard loom, chose not to exploit its greater flexibility. Rather, she chose to puzzle out her work within the more restrictive systems of harness weaving. In fact, she chose to work with her own self-imposed parameters, which conform to the limitations of this more basic form of weaving. Why? Well, for one, I believe that those constraints clearly work for her as a catalyst of creativity. But also, in doing so, her choices adhered to the theories and the philosophies of the Bauhaus weavers. They were constantly formulating these theories for their practice and discipline through written texts. And for them, the work in weaving was to be a reflection and articulation of the processes and systems of the medium. As Günther Stolz, one of the Bauhaus weavers, warned in her writings, they should not be making paintings of wool. And to go one step further, to weave a textile such as this with three warps and three wefts, red, black, and white, Annie Albers would have had to create a weave draft for each color area of the graphic. You can see that there are 11, to bring the correct interlacing of the threads onto the face of the cloth. And these four weave drafts, this is a quadrant, one here, one here, one here, and one here, would have resulted in the interlacing of these color warps and wefts coming to the face of the cloth. So as you can see, the grid-based language of weaving was firmly aligned with the outcome of the work, and it was firmly aligned with the grid-based language of the Bauhaus. The grid, in its being so minimal and elemental, served the Bauhaus well in their reaction to the visual and material overload of Victoriana and other excesses. This work was not only an outcome of organizing systems integral to the process of constructing cloth, but it was also developed as an articulation and expression of those systems, structures, and processes to be received by the viewer. For the Bauhaus weavers, the underlying principle of woven structure was both the starting point and the end point. And as an aside, I've included, where is my little thing? I've included these two weave drafts on the bottom because I appreciate how they relate to Rosemary Truckles and Sarah Charlesworth play on the close adherence between the geometries of constructed fabric and the geometries of modernism, which, as you can see, was a play of Annie Albers as well.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was great. Lisa, I have a question about that great sentence, like, don't make paintings of wool.
Yeah.
Were they making fabric to be manufactured?
No, I mean, these pieces of Annie Albers are really self-contained pieces. For her, they were art. And, but I think it was actually a term applied to the traditions of painting that existed before them. this wasn't existing in painting, as far as I know, and the flesh was part of, was it? No. Mm-hmm. That answer your question?
Yes.
All right. I have a brief introduction, which is going to be interrupted by Bob to talk about my first viewing of Annie Elbers, which happened in 1999. But I'm going to read first. The process of gathering facts and materials is a connective tissue. This connective tissue, artist to artist, surfaces and is repeated throughout the maze of history. Oh, sorry. We didn't change our... we didn't change. Oh, okay. As I have noted in the introduction to Henry, as is part of this program, Annie Elbers' demands for clarity and structure make me nervous. Of course it is to be remembered that she was a young woman in the chaos of pre-World War II in Germany. This investigation into the work of this serious artist has been invaluable to me, and I would have never undertaken it by myself. And I'm going to begin with how I was first introduced to Annabelle. Oh, I've forgotten, sorry. Start here with Annie Elbers' dedication for her book on weaving. The book is dedicated to my great teachers, the weavers of ancient Peru. I first became aware of Annie Elbers' work through my two friends, Bob Gober and Lisa Skull. And there you are.
Thank you. Well, I was led to Elbers from Lisa. She thinks we went to a show in New Haven together, but you know, it's a long time ago and I have no memory of that. Clearly I had a good exposure and was very curious about Elbers. And I curated a show back in 1999, 20 years ago, at Matthews Gallery. And what I was interested in including of Annie Elbers was one of what I think of as the classic weavings, but I had a more imaginative, I took liberties in my interpretation of the work. I wasn't that interested. I was interested in how she saw it. I may be more interested in it now. But I really saw these as, they were the size of a domestic tablecloth. And I thought that that was very interesting. A woman was weaving artworks that were tablecloths, or tablecloths that were artwork. And I thought that that blurry boundary was very rich, because so much happens at a tablecloth, around a tablecloth, with a tablecloth. When you talk about weaving and people sitting around it and talking and thoughts going back and forth, and so visually they were ravishing. And we were able, with Matthew's help, to borrow one from MoMA. And you know, I wrote to the Elbers Foundation. I tried to find this letter, but I don't have the letter, so this is my memory, maybe warping this. And I told them my plan for the exhibition, and I wondered in their holdings, did they have anything that I could exhibit, because I was looking for something to borrow in the show. And I got a very proper letter back saying they had nothing to lend, that this was an unusual way to present Annie Elbers' work. They weren't sure it was the best way, but they would not stop me from doing it. And I was telling Lynn before this, and said, I wonder what they'd say, like now, if you asked to put Annie Elbers' work into a more contemporary setting. I don't know, things change in 20 years. And so this show, when you talk about how things change in 20 years, let's see that show from the installation, Nancy.
This is the first show at Matthew Marks that happened in 1999.
Yep. Yep. And Annie Elbers is at the right-hand end, in the center is a sculpture of Katie Nolan's that she made for the exhibition. On either side are these large scale paintings by Joan Semmel, which I'll explain, and the TV was a video work by Robert Beck, who's now Robert Buck. And on the video screen what you saw was it was him and his dad, and his dad had gone hunting, and now they were sawing the antlers off a deer. So it was just the very, very repetitive work with the soundtrack of sawing the antlers off the skull of a deer. The Joan Semmel paintings, talking about that 20-year gap and how things are different, how they're appreciated and understood, those paintings were in the early, mid-70s. She made these paintings from her point of view, from her eyes looking down at her naked body, from her eyes looking down at her with her male lover, in different positions. And I saw these first in college, and I thought they were very important paintings. They were to me. And but then as time went by, it was very interesting to me that these were forgotten paintings and people really didn't know about them. And so that's part of what was interesting to me, was to bring them forward and to put them into a really interesting context to make people pay attention. And those paintings were in her loft, in her racks. No one had wanted them. She showed them, she put them away. Now, one's owned by the Whitney and one's owned by the Brooklyn Museum, to show you how things change in 20 years. And there was a smaller room on the back, and there's a series of photographs of Nancy's that also I had sort of the similar urge from. It's a body of work that was done in the mid-70s, and I knew at first. Were you doing them in Vermont, or was it New York?
Yeah, no, I did them in Vermont and in New York.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And I knew them from your little dark room in New York, and I remember how painstaking that you were with them, the backgrounds.
Oh,
it wasn't
God.
So much
uh-huh.
the shirts, it was what the background was, in terms of how, in black and white, how that was both neutral but energized at the same time.
I wanted the background to be equal to the t-shirts. And I think it took me 5 years to find the appropriate background. And sometimes I look back and, I've got a background of plywood, and I say, why didn't you think that was good enough? But it's interesting how things change. And that was really, really, really important to me at that point.
Yeah. I learned a whole lot from knowing Haim and Nancy. I remember going to their apartment in Middlebury, and on the wall were circulars from the supermarket that were pinned up in a serious way, the way you would put up paintings to look at. And as a dumb student, I was dumbfounded, oh, that's okay. And so it started me looking at everything as potential. I mean, we talked about going through dumpsters. We talked about going through dumpsters. Going to the junkyard.
The great equalizer of all things.
Yeah.
In which you can find a piece of almost anything.
Yeah, and your shirts functioned sort of the same way. You taught me to look at things.
I still think that's one of the most important things that an artist can do, is to observe what's in the world. And this is the show from Mama, and talk about that.
Well, it looks
just the same. But but I wanted to say the thing about Bob's first show, in terms of how faulty memory is, in my mind, that Annie Albers took over the whole space and was hung on the ceiling. And God knows how I got that. That certainly didn't happen. But I think in terms of the work that was in that show, it was the work that most touched me, and maybe that's why I remember it being so big. And in looking at these slides, X amount of years later, what strikes me is the distance between everyone's work and how important that is, and how it works so well that there are so many different positions that are laid out here.
This was from There's a survey of my work at MoMA in 2014, and Paulina Paboja is here tonight. She worked with Ann Temkin, and their idea and their choice was that there should be one of my curatorial efforts included in, you know, this snapshot of what I do. And it, for some reason, it was this one. I forget the reasons that it was recreated for him. And Nancy's photographs were, again, in a small adjacent room.
And for me, it was such a... it's more than a pleasure. It was really such an incredible comfort that these were in a show in 1999, which was probably 15 years after I had given up photography, I quit it. And then almost 20 years later, it was in this other show. And it, those t-shirts always feel like they were the beginning of my real work. And so it was just such a wonderful thing. Oh.
I think my part's over.
Okay.
Am I supposed to say more?
No, okay, I'm going on. It's my turn to go on. Bonnard, sometimes to understand anything, I must approach an issue, a thought, or an artwork from a contrary position, intuitively thinking through one side of things until I can see the other side. Thinking about Annie Elbers has led me to thinking about Bonnard. An aside here, Bonnard is always a major source of reflection for me. Unlike Elbers, I feel his engagement with the viewer through painting begins and ends in a refusal of clarity, a confusion that he then manages, heightens, and from which he chooses form. Surfaces which he identifies figuratively or texturally. He layers them together, using the physical thinness and the density of paint to deny edges and to deny immediate recognition of form. He uses distraction as a tool to force concentration on the viewer.
And you know, Nancy, tablecloths were very important. Although the painting we have does not have a tablecloth on, but tablecloths are really fundamental to Bonnard and his painting.
Be interesting to know practically every painting.
Yeah.
Seems that one can remember a bathtub or a tablecloth.
Yeah. And one time I saw a photo, I've never been able to find it again, of he was painting in a room with a real floral wallpaper on it, and he just had his canvas tacked on that, and then he was painting on that. Whoa.
Well, that's something that we've talked about, how he just put things up on the wall. They didn't have an edge. The edge wasn't determined until later, until the painting was finished.
Uh-huh.
So that's where we were sort of looping around, Nancy and I, one of our loopy conversations about pliable plane as well. That came back in on it, and
yeah.
It's that concept that we've been applying to so many different things and using it as a tool to talk about how painting, sculpture, skin, textile, all these things have a nexus where they come together and really form a dialogue, a language that crosses an incredible amount of ground, but retains some kind of really articulate way, form of measurement that you can actually engage in and move with. And that's been fascinating. That's something that I think we've been talking about for several months now. And to think that you could include Bonnard in this conversation tonight is in itself kind of like a stretch. Like, how could you do that? How could you bring Bonnard into this conversation? But then again, it really actually, I mean, just the fact that you now linked it up with tablecloths, I think we hadn't thought of that, but that's yet another line, an interweaving. And I could punt away tonight on weaving. What that all can mean.
Oh, sorry, here we are. Annie Elbers' work also creates visual conundrums. She creates a surface that the viewer cannot get away from. The eye is actively working to understand what is before it, the restless present, a tenuous balance of static and active visual elements is a primary consideration of both Bonnard and Annie Elbers. For me, this happens the same way a reader participates in reading fiction. There is a distribution of power between the object, the maker, and the viewer. Okay, this next lithograph I have to look at about 20 times because, or even more, every time I looked at it I thought, whoa, this is awkward. This is, I don't understand this. And then something changed and I understood it. And it is the way she was so uncomfortably able to unite both the background and the figure. And I think it's totally brilliant and probably my favorite thing of Annie Albers at this point, maybe because I had such a hard time looking at it. The mystery of equality in the figure-ground relationship is a conundrum both employ in their work. Annie Albers actually says this as an aside. Confusion always gets a negative rating. When I saw this, I was pretty dumbfounded because I couldn't decide why she was saying that, given what I know about her and her work and her idea about structure. And I was, she just throwing a bone to other kind of ways of looking things? Or is she really opening a door to other systems that she doesn't really want to investigate or believe in? And at this point, I really think she was opening a door. I think she's one of the broadest thinkers about visual activity that I've ever come across.
Nancy, can I say something? Brett, we were talking about the fact that Albert stopped weaving.
Right.
Lisa, do you understand why she chose to stop being a weaver?
Well, one factor was, I think it was hard physically at a certain point, but I have to say, I read she once said that if I make it in threads, it's craft. If I make it on paper, it's art, which kills me.
But you told me that the Bauhaus creations were viewed as artworks.
Yes, and she was. Yeah, but I don't know that she felt it was being received as such.
I see. Maybe that's a retrospective interpretation.
Yeah. Wasn't there also where she was picking up on this level of experimentation where the line, the thread is an event, which came a bit later, and then she moved into the lithographs, and she's picking up on that exact same thing. And that idea in itself was something that she really needed to explore in a way that was freed up from the warp and the weft, that it jumped out of that geometry and out onto the paper. And really, she took that, she let it go, she released it. She got into the knots and the tangles and the tying and the binding, and then she just released out from the grid.
Well, how old was she? And where was that in her career that she stopped weaving? And how long did she live?
Somebody just said 90s. She was 70.
No. Oh, wait, when she made that transition.
I think I read that physically it was just too difficult, the physicality of the loom and handling all that material. Okay, I'm going to go on unless I'm
going on.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit fatuzzed. This is what I want. Per Annie Albers' dictates, I am taking color out of the first place in a Bonnard painting. Color is a secondary element in the works of Annie Albers. Structure always in first, texture and then color. Bonnard, everything changes. One can drown in it. Boundaries. Bonnard made his own boundaries from the surface links of canvas he attached to the wall. And I can't help thinking of those links in terms of this term that I've learned from Annie Albers. It's so incredible to me, the pliable plane. And Lisa, did you know about the pliable plane in weaving school? Did they talk about it?
No.
Clear and present boundaries of the structure of weaving gave Annie Albers an infinite supply of verticals, horizontals, and even diagonals to work with against. She was primarily interested in presenting the viewer with activity based on the activity of threads. Annie Albers says, "My beginning was far from what I had hoped for. Put into my hands limp threads. Threads to build a future. But my distrust turned to belief, and I was on my way." Bonnard, everything changes. One can ground in it. I love the difference between those two voices that are, in a way, related and encompassing what we know. Anyway, that's done with my part, but Lisa has another part.
Plug in again.
Oh, thank you.
This is Chris.
So, I think I have to start over, right? There.
No.
Okay. My first encounter with this woven piece was at Annie Albers' retrospective in 1986 at Yale University. I had had the fortune to spend the afternoon with Annie Albers at her home, accompanying Jack Lerner Larson on a trip to New Haven to go to the opening of the show. And upon seeing the work, it was clear to me that this was art and that nothing was stronger than this. In this piece, she started with a strict system of three vertical configurations of color blocks, which provided a sense of order and stability. But the irregular ordering of those blocks subtly complicated things. With minimal elements such as the striping of the red and the white, thin bisecting lines, a suggestion of transparencies, she created a mesmerizing balance between a stability of visual structure and a subtle but perpetual shifting of form. It was like a tightly pieced together game board that had been opened up to air, light, and space. The shifting conditions that we experience in seeing and perceiving in this world felt present in this configuration of geometries. In general, I find the warmth and the experiential side of minimalism to be readily accessible. I take refuge in the cell-like squares of a Peter Halley painting, or I stay and wonder over how Solowit's overlapping parallel lines of color create an experience that transcends what I thought I understood. The woven work here by Annie Albers provides me with this experience as well. It also draws me into the act of puzzling out the systems, and it draws me into the act of Annie Albers puzzling out the systems. So do you want me to go into Peru?
Yeah.
Okay. For some reason, my cursor's not working. I'm stuck.
There it is.
Yeah,
it's a little.
No, but I can't. I'm not able now to move around in the system. Where would that be? I'm stuck here.
Can you exit and go back in?
Lisa worked for a long time in Peru. She knows the culture pretty well.
Do you want me to start with the control of delete?
Easy.
Wow. What
just, can you go next with the button to change
things? Oh, thank
yeah.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In the same year of the Annie Albers retrospective at Yale University, there was a show of ancient Peruvian textiles created by Jack Larson at the Marin Gallery in New York. And I had a response of similar magnitude to some of the pieces in that show. Simply, this was art, and nothing was stronger than this. Although I do not have images of those exact pieces, I found some images of pre-Columbian work that I think relates closely enough. These are examples of Nazca, Huari, and Chimu textiles all woven before 1500 AD. A collection of ancient Peruvian textiles in the Ethnological Museum in Berlin was studied by Clay and Annie Albers as early as 1922. And the study of these fabrics became part of the curriculum of the Bauhaus Weaving Workshop. I believe these fabrics had a significant impact on the thinking of the Bauhaus, Clay, and Albers. In reading reviews and essays responding to some of the recent shows of Annie Albers, you know, in the last couple of years, I've come upon statements claiming that she had elevated the medium of weaving from a domestic pastime to a level of fine arts. And this, I believe, ignores or dismisses the rich historical presence of textiles over past centuries in all cultures. Textiles, whether they be saddle blankets for camels in the desert, or wall hangings and floor coverings in Mongolian tents, they provided a great depth of visual and material engagement to counteract the relatively undifferentiated wide expanses of their environments. And these tunics and mantas, squares of fabric which continue to be made and used in Peru and Bolivia, they functioned as cloaks, shawls, or small blankets to give bodily protection and warmth, or as a mean of transporting potatoes to the market, or sticks to the fire, or to carry a baby on one's back. They were multi-purpose, pliable, functional planes of art. They played a role in the makers' and users' lives that goes beyond the utilitarian. And in many cultures, these fabrics were the highest form of art in the people's lives, and I believe they functioned as such. One interesting consequence of fabrics being pliable planes is that through their being readily transported and traded, they became significant cross-pollinators of visual and material culture. So I'm just going to say one more thing, then I'll pass it on to others. So, with this Kohistani's baby's hood, which was created along the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan in the early 1900s, it was stitched by a mother awaiting the birth of her newborn, which followed a long-standing tradition within that culture. The baby's hood was made of cotton and wool and was stitched by the expectant mother with various patterns, including the tree of life. And it was embellished with mirrors and beads and a ram's tooth, all for the end of protecting the child by warding off evil spirits. But what I think was happening here on another level was that the depth of commitment the mother was investing in the creation of this hood with care and love ultimately acted as a communication to community and family and as a symbol of the deep level of commitment she would be bringing to the care and to the protection of her newborn child in this world.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Lisa. Grant, I think it's time for the pliable plane.
Go for it.
I don't have my notes But I'm completely and absolutely and truly boggled by the range that this two words has. And she mentioned someplace, I don't have it right here now, that she was trying to find a form that was anonymous and that was big and didn't affect anything really, but affected everything. And I think this pliable plane is a real instance of her incredible vast thinking about things. And I feel like it's something that's so inclusive. It includes all these crafts and things that we have seen, but it also includes the totally ubiquitous present that we're all part of, like this shirt, this scarf, those things. And it functions in a way that we can hardly even see it. And I think that's truly part of her brilliance, as identifying this base as something that belongs to everyone, but we can't sort of see.
Yeah. Like, for instance, it's so ubiquitous that I think, as Nancy's saying, textiles can be blind to people, to the extent that when this is changing, our culture is slightly changing over the years, but I used to tell people I designed textiles, and I felt I might as well have told them I designed the inside of a matchbook, because they said, oh, someone designs that.
Well, I like it because it also jumps into the world of sculpture, really. I mean, it bridges disciplines, which are, I mean, the boundaries are all becoming more and more meaningless anyway. But it's just one more testament to that whole disintegration, that artificial sense of where certain parts of the art started, and that they were just parts and they needed to be kept separate. And this pliable plane really helps make that bridge, I think, really nicely. And the idea that it can just sort of jump off the wall, you know, these wool paintings, which were not to make, can, that concept, that this can then jump off the wall and become a sculpture, and it has. And that, I mean, we're sort of working on some of these things actively right now, I think, in the studio.
Yeah. Grit goes to the dump twice a week to see what we've left behind. And I go to the Salvation Army to see not what was left behind, but what is part of the things we think we know or don't know. And we formed a sort of club about investigating these materials, and that's been fun.
Do you want to do the show and tell?
Yeah, I'm going to do this show and tell now. When I was at Henry, I had a show and tell, and let's see, what I learned from that is the power of having the real object in front of you is so much more than a slide. So I brought a suitcase full of fabrics to talk about. In a way, I want to talk about them in terms of today and my modern life, which includes an incredible appreciation of crafts from other areas, which we, in our ignorance and arrogance, thought of as lesser. And I would get back to Lisa's point about these people who made these shawls to carry sticks. They were beautiful, and they were beautiful in these people's lives. And I don't see it here, but I'm going to present my show and tell. I brought this hat. And I just want to say something. I'm amassing a library of textiles that really are important to me. And in my thinking about textiles, and I want to thank Robin Grierson, who has provided me with my library. This is a hat from probably 1900, 1920, and I bought it from Robin because it was an extraordinary texture. And Annie Albers talks about this thing that we're not going to get into, but it's so big again, this thought about visual texture being so different from physical texture. And that's what I liked down in the show, that this Ed, what's his name?
Rossman.
He seemed very involved in that. And this hat is probably what Annie Albers was revolting against, right? But it also belonged to the women, the ordinary women who were suffragettes and trying to fit themselves into a political situation. And I brought this as a pliable plane, which I think is totally amazing. It weighs about 10 pounds, and it's for a really tiny person, that's the armhole. And it's so, well, Annie would hate it because it's embroidery, and embroidery is just decoration, but this heavy embroidery adds to the weight and adds to, I think, how this would act on a body. And I feel so bereft of, I'm going to say, choices and style. Why can I wear a pliable plane? And this, again, is from another culture. And it's so incredible to me because it's so like a drawing, and it was sewn together by someone who had a vision, and had a vision about it not matching up, because the not matching up creates a movement, and the movement with the figure. And this is just like the most beautiful drawing ever.
Where is it from?
Japan. And this is something that I just got. Again, I'm in debt to Robin. This is a skirt made for a child, maybe, in Gujarat. It's all hand embroidered. How long did this take? How many years did they start embroidering when the kid was a baby, and then when she was 14 or 15? And then the idea about pliable planes and that have two sides, like a front and a back, or what else is it called? A front and a back, or, I mean, this is the wrong side. This wrong side is thrilling. And this, in my sort of historical surveys, thanks to the Salvation Army, is a shawl from an elaborate Indian wedding garment. It was a skirt and a top, but it's so amazing because it's made of really, really cheap material, but I'm sure it wasn't cheap. It's all commercial, these trims and so on. But it's made from a tradition, and that tradition exists in this shawl. I mean, this is really, when you put this on, the decorative quality of it is amazing. And I'm turning myself into a birthday cake right now. But that has its own power. And I guess right now I'm feeling very much a lament for what we have, what the women who are the workers in this country, the mass working class women that I come from, like, they don't have very many choices. And the choices are what I think Annie Albers calls pre-formulated. And she has another statement about how it doesn't offer any creativity to a person. And when you think Annie Albers' love of industry at that point was sort of when it was quintessentially wonderful in some ways. It had integrity. And now it's moved so all the fabric is this horrible, horrible, oily, soft material that's supposed to be like silk. And human hand has been totally moved out of it. But in fact, I do love this. This is a photo reproduction put on a skirt. This is a really ugly skirt. It was short and had huge, huge, huge pleats like this. So any woman would look like really silly in it. But the fabric is so great. Anyway, that's what we're about now. These t-shirts with these stupid pictures. Let's see. This is the final. This is the most. The most. This is leggings. And it's for size 18 plus. Wow. And for me, it is an indication how industry has absolutely no respect for women and women who are working. And anyway, it's like, okay, I'm going to read the label because that's really interesting. The label is justice, not intended for sleep, which is meant to guard these anonymous companies. So if you slept in and you had a cigarette and it fell in bed and you got burned, you couldn't sue them because it would tell you not to sleep in them. Right. It's 90% polyester, 10% elastic. And the pictures are of donuts on your thighs and kittens with ice cream cones on top of their heads so that they look like unicorns.
Oh,
infantil, what's that word?
Infantilized.
Infantilized.
Women. And this is so beyond speech. There's a way that I sort of like it, but I hate it sort of more than I like it. Because for me, it's an indication of the embedded misogyny of industry and how we're only value of pennies on dollars. And the difference between these two things is totally astounding to me. And that's it.
Are there any questions? I'm sure there are. Hi. We have a notable sculptor here.
That was fantastic. Thank you so much. What an amazing evening. I have one question going back to the Annie Albers' early work when she first arrived at the Bauhaus and the grid-based work. And I have been wondering over the past couple of decades whether some of that work comes from Northern European traditions, working class traditions of weaving that's actually being done in Germany, in small villages, in local traditions for making like tablecloths, like linen weaving, where there are simple stripes, simple, very simple geometric patterns, and it sets some of actually the background of that work, and that she's actually taking some of that actual local tradition and bringing it forward into the art tradition. And maybe I'm wrong, but basically thinking about that time when socialism is of like the utmost concern, and that basically the sharing of resources, so actually the sharing of looms, and so collective use of looms at the time, and clubs being formed so that you could, so women especially could share use of looms, And whether this brings a kind of class content of her work forward into what she's doing, that there's a kind of another, a kind of content in there. Everybody always talks about industry, but there's also maybe this other, potentially this other content in there that's actually about, kind of what you're talking about, like about actually a background that she could have made come from her childhood and her you know, her teenage years, where she's, it's a working class background where basically weaving is a regular part of life at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of that traditional work that that could have grown out of her work. In fact, I had an opposite take that you have. I actually thought that the Bauhaus went to the minimalism of the grid and the square, possibly as a reaction to World War I, where all their systems, cultural, political, had failed, and that I had actually thought that perhaps in reimagining a new form and structure for society and living in this world, they actually looked backwards, but
yeah,
much further backwards, like to the, you know, those pre-Columbian textiles were of great inspiration to them. Going back to the basics was really inspiring to them versus what William Morris was doing, or again, referring to Victoriana, although it didn't exist in Germany, but
the philosophy itself also that was driving things, driving culture, and then had reduced in between the wars and what was building up into World War II, really brought on a kind of head about we need to clean things up.
Right.
And there was a different, I mean, I was surprised to see the word purity used so often by Annie Albers. It was like, this is a bad time to be talking about purity when we look at it historically, but giving her a break in the sense of how she's really using it is we have to clean up this. We have to go back to zero. We have to go to something where the slate is just clean. And like you said, going back, also the connection with Peruvian, that there was a source for that, too, that way back that wasn't connected directly to where things were in Europe at that time.
Didn't the Albers, both of them, spend time like in the 50s in Mexico? And I mean, they went to South America.
Yeah.
It wasn't just seeing collections in Europe. They actually traveled extensively.
A lot, many times.
And I know there's photographs that exist of them going down there. And I mean, significant periods of time.
Yes.
But I don't think that was the origin of their interest. I think it fed it.
Right.
Well, that was really fueled later at Yale, when the Albers got to Yale, too.
Hi. I have a question about time, but first I want to say I really appreciate hearing about Bonnard, because when I think about someone who does pattern on pattern on pattern so beautifully, he's always my reference. But my question, just, I'm sure many people in this room have theories about this, but I'd be curious to hear from you all. Why are we looking at Annie Albers so much right now? Like, what is it about this time that's making her work so incredibly pertinent, and, you know, the light is shining so brightly on it? And what's your, I don't know, any of you?
She's useful to so many people. She fits the bill for so many. I mean, she's so generous. Her work is so generous in so many ways. It almost doesn't matter where you come from when you look into her. This is my experience and a lot of people that I've talked to. It's just so generative in so many different ways that, and it's also, I mean, an old brother is a good thing right now, right? An old woman who knows how to do, and we like, well, it's a good time for women right now of that age. And she's so capable. I mean, articulate with her words. I mean, she really is quite deserving of everything that she gets. And it doesn't hurt that Bauhaus is also, the founding of it is 100 years ago, so there are a lot of things that are pointing to her justifiably.
And sometimes it just takes time. I I hit on Bonnard, but then there seemed to be a lot of sort of things that were similar. In my lifetime, he's gone from being just this pretty painter to someone who has a definite intellectual life as a painter. And I think that happens if it's just part of history. And I think the bereft, being bereft and having this pre-formulated material that I was showing you, I think that has raised the consciousness. And I know in my store that people don't even understand it. They have no idea. They don't know how important texture is at all, and they don't know anything about it's sort of boggling to me. There are two ends of people who come into Henry, and one says, did you make all this? And the other end says, thank you very much. This is like a museum. And then they leave, and I say, it's no museum I've ever seen, but there's no understanding of the real. And I think that may be part of it as well.
I have a question for Lisa. I know it was brief, but you met Annie Albers, and looking back, that was a long time ago. What's your memory of an afternoon with Annie Albers?
Well, she was so to the point that it always felt like it almost took the rug from underneath you. Like, I don't know if you've ever been with someone who doesn't skirt around the issues at all, or politeness sort of is a buffer. But there was something really, it seemed a type of wisdom to me. I perceived it that way, not Germanic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. but she was old, and she showed us her beautiful collection of, I think she was in her late 80s and or even 90. She died a couple of years after that.
Yep.
But she showed us beautiful Peruvian textures.
Steve?
Yeah, I don't think I ever heard before tonight, but maybe I'm just ignorant of this phrase, the pliable plane.
Yeah, why didn't we know about that?
it makes me think about a couple of things. I mean, one of them is it reminds me that, and I'm not a scholar or anything, but I think Deleuze or somebody wrote a lot about this PLI, this prefix or whatever, the fold, right? And maybe as sort of an alternative model to, you know, we think about the Bauhaus as being about, in modernism really, about using the grid and sort of simplifying or reducing, or maybe going back to Russian constructivism or something like that. But actually, you know, if you have this notion of the fold coming into the modernist grid, there seems like that's a place, I mean, you know, other people know more about this than I do, but you know, there may be other ways of thinking modernism than, I don't know, maybe this is the time for.
My thought, things are getting rethought, and she, for me, she's the fulcrum for rethinking a lot, for rethinking what she calls here pre-formulated, to rethinking what we think about these other societies who were so intent on making beauty in their lives. That's what I think.
I was also thinking of, I don't know if this is too biographical, but I wonder if anyone has a thought about this. The pliable plane might also relate to the fact that Annie Albers came from a printing family. Her family printed newspapers, and actually the book Malls Quiet on the Western Front, and also dress patterns. That's where they made their money. And so this notion of the pliable plane, of going from two-dimensional to three-dimensional, is actually something that's located in her childhood. And there's a second thing I wanted to talk about, which I really don't know what to make of, but I feel like should be raised, is that Annie and Joseph Albers fled Europe because Annie was Jewish, Joseph was not. And Annie Albers
famously said that she was Jewish in the Hitler sense. This is a quote, unquote. She was not a religious person. But she did end up making six prayers and a bunch of religious works. And it's on my mind just because of this crazy, really horrifying executive order by Donald Trump making Jews a national identity, which is actually, you know, that's directly out of the playbook of white supremacy. So it's, I think, interesting to be looking at Annie Albers for a number of reasons. I mean, a lot of people have been looking at Annie Albers for years for good reason. But I have all these historical things going on in my head at the moment while we're talking about Annie Albers.
Yeah, I feel all of that in her work and in her position about taking weaving, which is, as Gret says, is something that has been part of our lives since we were cave people. And it does, everything fits into everything else, and I think she knew that, and I think she was very aware of politics in relation to what she was doing.
Yeah, Arthur Danto wrote a great piece, Weaving as Metaphor, in Fabric Workshop, in which he goes into this a little bit. It's not a long piece, but it's a really nice introduction to that whole way of thinking, and he goes to Plato, and Plato's use of weaving as a metaphor for a state, and that a state needs all different types of people, and the other arts you can do without. It's too much fantasy, it's too much decoration, but weaving is an honorable and an elevated thing, and it's a model for the best state that one could form, where people of all different places and types and abilities would be come together, would be interwoven.
And what did she speak to the pliable plane as any kind of confrontation with the dominance of architecture?
Yeah, it was mentioned always in relation to architecture, to the arts. But I think I have some, if I can find it, I think is probably more important, where she always brought forward, as opposed to the arts, how important the pliable plane was as an unseen, anonymous part of everyday life. I'm so bad at this. Okay. Our households contain hundreds of objects, Annie Albers. Finding a form for something, finding a form as anonymous as possible. That is, a form unburdened by dominantly individual traits of the planner. I think this is her definition of pliable plane. To me it is. And this meaningful form can become the carrier of meaning that takes us beyond what we think of as immediate reality. This is just like amazing thinking. And she's an upholder of the anonymous, which is part of your tradition of being a weaver, because Leifa never puts her name on any of her fabrics. And I think Albers was really understood that in terms of workmanship. Okay. It should be subservient, not dominating. That's, I'm going to leave you with the pliable plane.
Oh.